How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. In this episode, we're chatting about the field of genetic counseling 50 years ago in the 1970s. My guest today is Virginia Corson, who is a seasoned genetic counselor. Virginia has spent the vast majority of her career as a prenatal genetic counselor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's written countless publications with original research, case reports, book chapters, professional society statements, you name it. She earned her Master's of Science through the original genetic counseling program, Sarah Lawrence College, which I also graduated from a few years ago. This episode is part of our genetic counseling history series, backed by the National Society of Genetic Counselors Late Career Special Interest Group. So be sure to check out other episodes. Previously, we did 234, 235, which explore the first few NSGC conferences and the formation of the American Board of Genetic Counselors, ABGC. So links in the show notes for all of those, also available at dnatoday.com. But Ginny, thank you so much for coming on and kind of doing a blast from the past, as I've said before, with some of your colleagues.
Kira, my pleasure. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of this, like, I don't know, because I wasn't a genetic counselor in the 70s. So I love episodes where I get to learn a lot. So when did you first learn about genetic counseling? Because, like, I learned in high school, but it may be different for those that started in the field a while ago.
Kira, I learned in college, and it was a little bit by chance. I was a biology major at Princeton and was taking a variety of courses and took exactly one religion course. It was an ethics, and this professor each week did a different topic, like abortion or euthanasia or war, birth control. And one week he did a topic on genetic counseling. And I went, whoa, that sounds interesting. And
I don't even remember
exactly what was in that particular course, but the idea of, you know, genetic counseling struck me as a way to combine my science background and working with people. And this was in, actually, I looked up my transcript. This was in 1971. So I took that course literally, months after the first graduates from the Sarah Lawrence program. So I just happened to be in the right place at the right time to hear about this profession, and it stuck in my head. And so a couple of years later, I thought, well, you know, let me give it a try. So it was really funny that I heard about it in something sort of completely different than a science course. Yeah.
I'm shocked that, like, at that time, there was a whole lecture dedicated to it, like, within your course. And, I mean, that sounds like one of the best courses in college, which is, like, bioethics. Yeah. And it, I mean, spanned out a little bit from bio, but that's really interesting. And shocking that, yeah, that was, like, a year after the first graduates of Sarah Lawrence. So you were ahead of the time in terms of learning about it.
It was early on for sure. And it's, you know, it's one of the, my parents kept saying, what are you talking about? What is this program you want to go to? Because nobody had heard of genetic counselors at the time.
Right. And I used to say that when I was telling people I was going into genetic counseling, but like you actually meant it. Like nobody knew about this. It was just like, you know, probably, you know, a few dozen people knew about genetic counseling at that point. And, you know, 69, 70, 71. So can you describe the landscape of the genetic counseling field? Kind of give us an overview of what it was like in the 70s? Because you said you're taking this course like early 70s and then you graduate, you're going through grad school in the 70s, starting your work. I mean, how did the field look? Because it's very different than it is now.
Very few hospitals had genetic counselors at that time. So to find a job was quite tricky. And there were, you know, there were no emails, there were no job postings. really online. And so what many of us did, including myself, is to take the directory for the March of Dimes Birth Defects Foundation, called at the time, and that listed genetic centers. And so we would type, there were no computers either, we would type individually cover letters to each of these places and send out about, 40 or where, wherever you thought you might want to work. So you just blind sent letters to places you thought might be interested in hiring a genetic counselor. So that's what I did. And then you were lucky, you occasionally you would get a phone call. And one day I got a phone call, from Dr. Hay Kazazian at Johns Hopkins. And I didn't know who he was. Turns out he ended up being a big geneticist, but I had heard of Johns Hopkins. So
yes,
I said, okay, and went down and interviewed. But it was a time when, I was the first genetic counselor there. They didn't know what I could do, what I couldn't do. So it was a time where genetic counselors had to sort of prove what they could do, had to demonstrate, had to earn respect, and then slowly over time got additional responsibilities. So it was really, and there was a little bit of turf war, like what could I do versus the physicians. And it was a time where often genetic counselors were sort of coordinating clinics, doing less counseling, but doing scheduling, doing more administration than direct counseling. But that then, over time, worked into greater roles and responsibilities. And things like teaching and supervising and writing, different things that came. But in the beginning years, it was a lot of clinic coordination and sort of explaining general inheritance patterns, really.
Yeah. And as we'll get into, like, where were the specialties at that point? But before I get into that, I mean, how did the advancements in genetic testing and technology impact the 70s? Like, were there any notable breakthroughs you can, think of, or anything that really was influencing the field around this
time? I don't remember breakthroughs per se. What I sort of do remember, and this is probably from my own job, was sort of advances like carrier screening for Tay-Sachs disease. That was truly coming into its own, and it was the first real carrier screening that we offered at that time based on ethnic background. And Hopkins had, I believe, the first or one of the first outreach programs in synagogues to offer Tay-Sachs screening. That was before my time, but when I came to Hopkins, they were just starting to set up a clinic where weekly couples could come in or individuals to have their blood drawn for Tay-Sachs carrier screening. So that was sort of a big focus at that time, and it was a little bit kind of off the grid. In other words, we didn't have phlebotomists. People would come in, I'd grab a doctor to draw a blood sample, maybe Dr. Kazazian or one of the fellows, draw a blood sample, then I'd hand carry the blood over to the lab. We didn't have billing systems. We asked people for donations to the Tay-Sachs screening program.
Wow.
And then results came back to us, and I would send out letters. I don't know if it was even truly in some kind of electronic medical system. It was really a little bit, off the grid in terms of trying to get it organized. But that kind of screening was a big focus at the time. There was also, in my job in pediatrics initially, great expertise in metabolic disorders. So the newborn screening was expanding, more conditions were being diagnosed. We followed children that had special diets, and we would see those families frequently. So from my memory, it was more an era of metabolic genetics, biochemical genetics. There was really no DNA testing, no molecular testing. So that came later, and it wasn't even really till the 90s that became such a big part of genetic counseling. And that then led to expansion of positions in oncology and cardiology, and these other specialties that now had molecular testing to be able to offer to families. And that was perfect for genetic counselors to explain. Yeah.
Yeah, because the field, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of more started in the prenatal area, mm-hmm. and then expanded out into like pediatrics and then cancer. So in the 70s, was it really mostly prenatal and a little pediatric, like
so
metabolic?
I was hired in pediatrics. So it was in my mind, pediatrics and also prenatal. In my position, in pediatrics. I worked for 3 years at Hopkins, and then they were reorganizing the prenatal clinic, which did exist, but it wasn't really staffed by people with genetics backgrounds, interestingly. It was pediatricians and obstetricians that were staffing that service. And it was felt that we needed better genetics organization of that clinic. So the people who were involved left at that time or were asked to leave, I'm not sure. Dr. Kazazian right. became the director of that clinic, and then I switched to become prenatal. And for me, it was somewhat of a lateral switch from pediatrics to prenatal, but it was a whole different area for me. So it was learning a whole different, you know, kind of counseling. And at that time, we hired a pediatric counselor. And then later, at the end of the 70s, there was a DNA diagnostic lab at Johns Hopkins that started to offer DNA testing initially just for the hemoglobinopathies. And a genetic counselor was hired in that laboratory. So sort of by the end of the 70s, we had 3 genetic counselors at Hopkins. And then the next counselor to be hired was in the adult genetics clinic, and that was Dr. Victor McCusick's clinic. So
that's a name.
That was, you know, one of many geneticists at Hopkins that I was privileged to work with, but many of us think of him sort of as the father of genetics or the father of sort of clinical human genetics. Yeah,
definitely. I mean, people of my generation know the name McCusick. So, right. I mean, that definitely still holds a lot to it. So, and I'm just like curious. So in prenatal, when you were kind of after 3 years, you're pediatric, and then you kind of switched to prenatal all within Hopkins. But I mean, what would you even talk about in sessions, and like what kind of testing could you offer back then? Because a lot of DNA sequencing, like that
Nothing.
Wasn't a thing then.
So at that time, it was pretty much amniocentesis or nothing. It was chromosome risks. So advanced maternal age, perhaps a previous child with a chromosome abnormality. There were some biochemical tests that we could do on amniocytes. So for example, for Tay-Sachs disease, one could do prenatal testing. But truly, there were no molecular tests that we could really offer then. By the end of the 70s, maybe sickle cell through that DNA lab I mentioned could be done, and then eventually thalassemia. But we didn't really, you know, it was... People didn't have options then. So we could talk about, you know, if you had a child with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, we could talk about what the recurrence risk was. We could do an amniocentesis to see the sex of the fetus, but we really couldn't do a test to determine, you know, whether the fetus had inherited a gene or, you know, was healthy in terms of that situation. So it was...
So it was all karyotypes back then, basically, and then the molecular or the biochemical, if there was
Correct.
Something like Tay-Sachs.
And
like
then the molecular initially was linkage. You know, we didn't have specific gene mutations, but we could link variations in the gene to the actual mutation. And so that was something, but it still, you know, might have had an error rate up to 5%. This kind of thing. So in the early days of molecular, we didn't know specific mutations, but we knew where the gene was and we could figure out what was nearby. And so we could offer linkage analysis. But yes, early on it was, and ultrasound was available, but very rudimentary when I started doing prenatal. Amusingly, ultrasound for localization for an amniocentesis was done in one area. And then the patient was moved to labor and delivery, another area, for the actual amniocentesis. I think they thought perhaps it was more sterile or something, but you would locate a spot and then 2 hours later do the amnio. It sounds, in retrospect, completely crazy. So,
wow. So they didn't use ultrasound while actually performing the amnio?
In the early days, of course. And then, of course, over time, ultrasound got, you know, much better at looking at the anatomy of the baby, you know, being able to look for birth defects or recurrence risks for skeletal abnormalities. But early on, you know, you could measure and you could sort of locate a spot for an amnio, but it was not very advanced in the beginning.
I mean, that makes sense because even like, you know, I've talked to my mom about like her pregnancies of me and my brother, and even in, you know, I'm 28. So, you know, 29 years ago when she was pregnant with me, like even in that time, things have changed a lot where we can kind of say, well, we're thinking it's this sex, even at like the NT scan nowadays, which, you know, is not even a thing back in, you know, 95 when I was growing. But yeah, so tell me then, with not many genetic counselors in the field yet, you know, you were at Sarah Lawrence, which totally makes sense because that was, you know, one of the only programs at the time. I don't remember when Rutgers, you know, opened and the other programs around that time. But I noticed that, you know, you graduated a year after you got your degree from Princeton with your bachelor's. So it was only a year then, because nowadays it's 2 years.
Well, it was curious because the program at Sarah Lawrence sort of started really organized for women who were wanting to go back and have a career. Maybe they were raising a family, maybe they had worked, maybe not, but the courses were really offered pretty much part-time in the early years. So you would stretch it out over 2 or 3 or maybe even 4 years taking the coursework. And then once people heard about it, there were some people like myself coming right out of college that were interested in doing the program. And they decided they could pack it into 1 year. And so there was a transition period where a few classes of, again, mostly women, were able to do the coursework in 1 year. And that was a lot of work. There were still not that many courses. There were really only about 5 courses, if you can imagine how many you had, Kira. There were about 5.
That was just, there were 5 in one semester for me, and I had 4 semesters. Courses,
but we had to do clinic rotations, and we had to do some additional what was called field work. So we rotated, in addition to the clinics, my rotations were in a cytogenetics lab, and I, for a while, did interviews in a miscarriage study. So there were different. I also did a month at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, which was great. You know, we had a January off, and so we could all arrange an elective. So I went to that hospital, which was good. So it was a lot, but it was physically possible to do it all in 1 year. I don't know how long that lasted. Maybe only a couple of years. I'm not sure. But it was a transition period of time. And so that's why it was only a 1 year program for me.
Yeah. And it must have been like, you know, I mean, it makes sense that you did cytogenetics. Like, I got my bachelor's in cytogenetics. So, you know, and now I feel like that now my program doesn't even offer a cyto concentration. It's just molecular, which I'm like, wow, you know, times are changing just in the 5 years since I graduated from undergrad. But so what kind of classes were you taking, and like how many rotations did you have? Like, were there enough spots for you guys? I mean, it was obviously a smaller class back then.
It was probably smaller, but it was still a pretty big class, I think. And rotations, it was great to be in the New York area. Because, as you know, there were rotations all over the city and then even in the suburbs. So a couple of mine were in New York. I was at Mount Sinai Hospital. I was at Albert Einstein Hospital. The one that I remember, you know, in amazement was that I had a rotation at Creedmoor, I think it's Institute, which was a Huntington's disease program. And I don't know exactly the purpose of the interviews, but they would have a genetic counselor like myself in a room along with somebody who was at risk for Huntington's disease and just let us talk to them and interview them. And I'm not sure what they used those, and I think we even taped the interviews with their permission. But we were really just left on our own to sort of spend time with these people and get a sense for what it was like to have a family member with Huntington's disease. And that one really sticks in my mind. I had another rotation that was in prenatal, I think, at North Shore Hospital. So I think we had 4 clinical rotations in addition to the what they called field work at various settings.
Wow, that's a lot to pack into 1 year. And like, and for the Huntington's disease clinic or whatever that was called, like at that time there was no, oh, do you want to test for it? Because, you know, I had to Google as you were talking. But not so that we discovered the gene in 93. Yeah. So that was like, you know, 20-ish years after you were doing this. So it was really just talking about like letting them know
what is dominant inheritance, right?
It was 50%. Yeah,
that
okay.
kind of thing.
Right?
No testing. So, and again,
pure counseling.
What's, you know, how does it feel? You know, what does it seem like to be at risk? What's your experience with having somebody with HD in the family? You know, often it was a parent. Could have been a grandparent. Often it was a parent. But to go back to the idea of coursework, of course, we didn't have any, we didn't have to have a class in molecular because there was no molecular. We didn't have to learn cancer genetics, for example. It just didn't exist then.
So it was really then just throughout your career, just, you know, going to conferences and everything was just very important, especially because you couldn't just hop on the computer and listen to a Zoom call, you know. So it was like, I imagine going to NSGC was like really important every year to be like, what have the new discoveries been on top of just reading new publications throughout
it was critical in terms of continuing education for genetic counselors. It was and back in the early days of NSGC, there were also regional meetings. So, you know, there were six regions of the society, and they would hold also independent meetings and have speakers come in. So those were critical. And also being in a place like Johns Hopkins, you know, people would at conference talk about new things, and different people were reading things. There were journal clubs where you would have updates. But it was really sort of learning on your own, honestly, some of the new advances. And it was great to have eventually genetic counselors in each of these departments. So I in prenatal, I didn't have to know everything. You know, there were counselors in cardiology, and there were counselors in oncology. And if you had a family history where that was of concern, you could then refer a family to another genetic counselor with that experience.
So do you remember, like, in the 70s there being a cardio or a genetic counselor in the cardio department?
No, not in the 70s.
I was going to say, wow, that was so
later.
Early.
Not
so,
until
okay,
later.
All right. You're talking about later.
Later.
Gotcha.
When we had testing available.
Yeah.
That's when these other departments typically would hire genetic counselors. Yep.
Yeah, because even I'm imagining in prenatal, like, nowadays, like, we could pick up heart defect, and then I might be talking about that with a patient. But back then, I'm assuming that ultrasounds could not pick up any differences.
Pretty much not.
Heart.
No, it was the heart was beating or not beating. Pretty much.
Right. Yeah. It was just kind of heartbeat checks as we do today, but like that's what it was back then.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So I know we've talked about kind of your role at Johns Hopkins and being in prenatal, but like, what was a typical day like? I mean, how many patients were you seeing? How long was a session? Like, you know, how do you feel like it differs maybe from like what I do in prenatal today?
Well, you know, sessions for me typically were about half an hour in the early days, so to speak. Everybody got a family history. That was standard. Do a pedigree. Talk about why they came, you know, what their risk was, maternal age or whatever. Talk about what testing was available, which in the early days was amniocentesis or nothing. Doesn't take too long. Talk about the procedure. Talk about what the results could mean, decisions that they might face. When would the results come? And of course, back in the 70s, an amniocentesis result took about 4 weeks. So as you can imagine, that's a long time to be waiting, but that's where the cell culture, you know, technology was. So that's where I started. But as you well know, over time, that expanded to screening options like a low AFP or a triple screen or a quad screen, and eventually first trimester screening. CVS got thrown into the mix in the late 80s for us. So that was an earlier option for a diagnostic test. And then eventually, of course, cell-free DNA. And so the counseling session took a lot longer. You had to explain all these options. If you saw somebody at 10 weeks of pregnancy, for example, you would need to talk about both diagnostic testing, CVS or amniocentesis, and screening. Whatever, you know, whatever was available at the time. And then on top of that is, what are you going to do with the sample that you get? Let's say you do an amniocentesis or a CVS. Do you do a karyotype? Do you do a microarray? You know, luckily I've retired a little too soon for the whole exome sequencing and genome sequencing to be a real issue for me. But, you know, over time we had to then decide when to talk about these technologies and, you know, explain it to the patient. So, you know, a half an hour genetic counseling session is now, you know, typically an hour, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm booked for an hour. Yeah, I don't always use all of that time, depending on what the indication is and everything. But sometimes, you know, I'm going over if it's an abnormal reason that they're coming in. And so the karyotypes, like, you know, just being someone that has done, I don't know, I want to say hundreds of karyotypes in my time of being in the lab back a few years ago, So with that, were you, I'm trying to think of where we were in the 70s. So was it band for band, or was it like single staining, or like it was like not was great? Not,
you could count them and you could put them in groups and you could tell them apart, but there was very little banding. So that of course, you know, greatly increased over the years.
Yeah, because I imagine, like, I mean, I struggled enough as I was learning to be like, okay, which chromosome is which? Like, four and fives look very similar, and they're, like, really the same size. The banding looks very similar. So I can imagine if you didn't even have bands to be like, okay, these are the groups. Yeah. And, you know, if you see an extra chromosome that's, you know, looks like the shape of a popcorn almost, you're like, okay, well, maybe that's Down syndrome of the extra 21. But yeah, I imagine there were some cases where they're like, well, we see an extra chromosome, but we're having a hard time figuring out which one it is.
Or an,
like,
extra piece of chromosome, so too. An extra piece,
or
right.
Piece.
So that, you know, I think banding had started in the 70s, but it really was at the very beginning. And the other thing that was different about a counseling session then was you didn't really have to talk too much about carrier screening. You know, if you saw a couple that was Jewish, you would offer Tay-Sachs screening. That was pretty much it. An African-American couple, you might talk about sickle cell screening, but you didn't really have to offer testing for additional, like cystic fibrosis, for example. You know, that was a whole deal.
Fragile X, spinal muscular atrophy,
nothing. And so now there are, as you know, hundreds of things. And, oh, you know, do you do this panel or that panel, and how much do they want to know? And so that's another component of the counseling session that has certainly greatly increased in time to talk about that.
Yeah. And at the time you were, you know, obviously you've had quite a career in genetics, but you had, you know, your, what do we call that? 15 minutes of fame outside of genetics, because you were on the front cover of the Wall Street Journal article in the 70s, which is like really cool. So what was this article about? How did that impact genetic counseling? Like, I think of just, you know, in the 10 years I've been involved in genetics, of the big times where things have hit mainstream media. But what was this all about? How did this even come to be? How did you end up on the front cover of
this
Wall Street Journal?
This was later than, this was towards the end of the 80s, actually, when this article hit. But there was,
there was
a doctor at Hopkins who had been interviewed for an article by this journalist who was just interested in genetics. And the writer wanted to do a different approach. He wanted to make it more human. And so this doctor at Hopkins said, oh, I think maybe why don't you talk to Jenny? So he came to the office a couple of times, actually. He sat in on some counseling sessions, interviewed me, so had talked with patients. And, you know, I didn't realize it was going to turn out to be the front page of the Wall Street Journal, the dot blot on the left-hand column. I didn't realize that, but it ended up being fun because, of course, people saw it, you know, around the country, and, you know, my dad was so proud, and and for a while it was included, I think, in packets of information from Sarah Lawrence when they were sending it out to prospective students.
Of course, be like our you know, alumni, you know, are featured.
Right.
And,
so it was my 15 minutes, right. It was fun. You know, it just happened to be by chance that the author was interested, and the doctor set him up with me. So it was fun.
Yeah. No, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty remarkable, especially back in that day, I think, when everybody was more focused on print media and everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, we've been talking about, you know, just how things have changed in the field. Any other like challenges or things that was really hard in the 70s, or anything that was kind of like an ethical or legal consideration at this time? Like, I know we've kind of talked about more the technology side and just what was available, but anything else that comes to mind?
Well, you know, I think the sort of ethical and legal things happened a little bit more with the development of molecular testing. You know, back in the 70s, you know, and throughout, there's always been sort of the question of doing procedures for identifying the fetal sex of the baby, and whether that would influence people's decisions about continuing a pregnancy. So that, I think, prenatal centers have struggled with since the beginning. But otherwise, it was more a time of trying to establish one's own job role and responsibility, and a little bit of turf wars with the physicians, and just trying to establish the National Society of Genetic Counselors. That happened at the end of the 70s. And many physicians were concerned about whether genetic counselors could do counseling independently without a doctor in the room. That at the time was, a sort of a big debate and topic of discussion. But I don't remember really particular legal problems back in those days. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. There just wasn't as much
right
to consider at that time. But, you know, we talked about, in episodes, 234, 35, about the, forming NSGC and ABGC, and also just like that turmoil time when geneticists and other physicians and everything were like, genetic counselors, they can't do like what we do, and kind of breaking away from them, because I imagine you were part of the crew that was taking the same exam as geneticists.
Correct.
So like you had to know as much as a geneticist, mm-hmm. which like I can't imagine passing that nowadays. But right. I mean, so, it was after that where you guys then kind of, you got grandfathered in, mm-hmm. but people were taking separate exam that it wasn't with the
geneticists. So we took the same general core as the MD geneticists, and then we would take a genetic counseling and they would take a medical. So we each took then separate.
Okay,
separate,
so it was a yep. little bit separate.
So we took the same okay. core. And we did that really for about 10 years or so. And that was when the American Board of Medical Specialties said, we will allow admission of the American Board of Medical Genetics, but you can't bring the genetic counselors with you. That was what happened. And it was really honestly devastating to be told that we would no longer be sort of part of that community. It was a really difficult time. But honestly, in the long run, it forced, so to speak, the genetic counselors to establish a new organization, to decide how they wanted to, credential genetic counselors to be responsible for their exams, and then to go on and accredit the graduate programs. So although a time of strife, it ended up probably to the advantage of the genetic counselors, because we were forced to go out on our own, so to speak, and it's worked well.
It was growing yeah. pains, but right. yeah, it ended up being a good thing in the long run. But wow, I mean, I just have to say, Jenny, your memory is impeccable. Like the fact that you can recall all these things, you're talking about it as if it was like, oh, a couple years ago. Yeah, this is what we did. I'm like, wow.
I did a little bit of homework. I have to say, I did look back a little bit at dates and things.
Sure, but I mean, still, the way, I asked you some questions off the cuff that was not in our outline and everything, but no, I mean, this has just been incredible just to see how the field was, compare it to today, and I think it gives people an appreciation for just how far the field has come in the last 50 years. I know the class before me was the 50th class from Sarah Lawrence, so, we're at probably 53, 54
right.
by now,
exactly.
Years of, I kind of consider when Sarah Lawrence was starting, that's the birth of yep. genetic counseling. But, I mean, Jenny, thank you so much. I mean, I feel like you were just the perfect person. Caroline Lieber is the one that mm-hmm. kind of connected us. And, she was spot on with saying Jenny's the person. So.
Well, it's been fun to chat, for sure.
Yes, thank you so much. For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.